This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we explore just what it takes to be a Level 1 trauma center, and what are the essential and necessary health screenings for women throughout their lives. But first, some inspiring stories from the spiritual care program at Upstate University Hospital. Despite all the modern advances in medical science, there's so much more to healing than drugs and procedures alone. Spiritual care plays a key role. We'll hear with more on this our Reverend Terry Culbertson. She's the manager of the Department of Spiritual Care at Upstate Medical University, and Walt Wasilewski. He's a lay volunteer with the Center for Spiritual Care. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
So, Walt, I understand that you have just written a book all about your experiences as a spiritual care volunteer. Tell us about it.
Well, the book arose from the wonderful diversity we have of people who volunteer, and also the paid people and the chaplains and everyone involved in spiritual care. They bring an enormous amount of life experience and training to what we do. And I was amazed at some of the stories I was hearing from these volunteers. So with Reverend Culbertson's encouragement, I interviewed 18 of the volunteers and ask them to tell stories about the moments in their experiences at Upstate in spiritual care where they felt the presence of the Spirit in what they were doing.
And you have a background. I mean, you're not just, you are a lay person.
Yes.
Here, but you're a writer.
Yes, I worked many years in journalism, and I still do. I worked at the Post Standard here in Syracuse for 28 years. I write for magazines currently, and I also teach at Syracuse University. I teach news writing and news ethics at the Newhouse School.
Yeah, so you have quite an august background.
I've been around a while.
Yes. But so this was really to highlight the diversity of the volunteers, but also kind of the breadth and depth of their experiences.
Exactly. They some of the people who volunteer with us have amazing abilities. I've seen them. You know, I've been standing next to them when things have happened and we've reached out to patients and their loved ones. And some of the things that have happened are astounding at just how skilled these volunteers are and just how knowing and wise they are about how to prepare a place in time in our place in this hospital so that the Spirit can do its work. The doctors and nurses are always doing their work. The Spirit is as well, but just as the doctors and nurses need things to prepare the patient to receive that care, it's the same with spiritual care. So we work very hard on that. And one of the things we do, first and foremost, is focus on the patient, because that's entirely what we do. That's how we start on our journey with them. And it's just interesting to hear people tell these amazing stories about things that happened to them and insights they had. And so that's what the book's about.
I'm going to ask you to give us some specifics in a minute, but let's get back to what does it mean, Reverend Culbertson, to be a spiritual care volunteer? I mean, what are they doing? And what's their background? What's their training?
Great question. So many departments of spiritual care in this country utilize volunteers to supplement the professional staffing care, and we're no exception. Actually, the history of our department is for the past 50 years that it's existed, is that volunteers have always been part and parcel. And some of them are faith-specific volunteers, like a Eucharistic minister in the Catholic tradition who would bring Holy Communion to the bedside. Some of them have a very broad spirituality that addresses things that are maybe less religious but more spiritual. They come from.
So they might not be necessarily aligned with any particular tradition, mm-hmm. but they have a general sense of the spirit and the importance of that in the healing process.
Exactly, that spirituality can be very broad. Most of our folks, we do require folks to be housed in a congregation to come from. So that there's some basis of their faith. But we, as Walt mentioned, are very inclusive. So our folks don't just see people of their tradition, but people of all or no traditions, with the belief that that enhances their healing process.
How many people generally are involved at any one time?
We have over 100 volunteers in our department. They do a variety of different things. Some of them are, like Walt, direct bedside volunteers who visit once a week. Some of them are on-call clergy in the community. We have 45 of them, and they help cover the after hours so that we can go home once in a while. And we have such a variety, as Walt said, folks who are lawyers, people who have been ministers, lay people who have taught. We just have quite the variety of people in our department. But our goal is to be there for the patients. And I want to add this to what Walt said. We also believe that we become transformed through the encounter. And I believe the book is about that as well. That's part of what we gain personally.
So that's a segue to the next question I wanted to ask you, Walt. What did you learn by writing the book?
I tell people, and this is true, I felt like it was a six-month intensive tutorial in the best practices of spiritual care. Mm-hmm. I learned so many things. Some of it esoteric, some of it fairly difficult to ponder, a little bit hard to grasp sometimes, but an awful lot of practical things. Mm. What do you say when this happens? How do you react when that happens? And all of these stories came out, and it was just I spent an hour or two with 18 of these people sort of debriefing them about all the great things that they've learned. And that helped me learn, because I've embodied that into what I do at Upstate. Mm. It has affected the way I relate to patients, the way I relate to this practice. Mm. And that's the hope, that the book will do the same for people in other places, mm-hmm. other hospitals, other settings, mm-hmm. where they might read this and be a little bit inspired and say, gee, I never saw it from that vantage point. Or, boy, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And help them.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Reverend Terry Culbertson and volunteer Walt Wasilewski. We're talking about spiritual care volunteering and a very meaningful book that Walt has just written about these experiences. Help us, tell us some, you know, share some of those experiences that you had as a volunteer that may have been highlighted in the book.
In the book. Well, we tell a story in the book. It was written by one of our former clergy people. Who worked here for many years. And it was about this woman named Helen Philipsack.
Right.
Her story was remarkable and charming in every way. And she was a charming person.
She was charming.
Long past the age of retirement, it popped into her head that she might like to volunteer as a spiritual caregiver. And she asked the Reverend, Babel.
Father Babel,
how to pronounce his name. But Father Babel, whether that was possible. And he said, yes, but, you know, you have to train for this. Mm. And then she went through this rather rigorous training. She mm-hmm. had to drive to Binghamton every day and everything to get the training. But she stuck with it and began volunteering. And she volunteered well into her 90s.
Well, she was 75 when she started, and when she finished, she was 91.
Yes. Wow.
And going strong, and I never saw Helen come off the floor without saying, I just had the most wonderful day visiting patients. She mm-hmm. glowed.
Yes.
She really glowed.
Well, that just underscores for me what you were alluding to before, which is it's a growth experience for both.
Exactly.
Correct.
That both the patient and the person who's attending to their spiritual needs are mm-hmm. growing from it, hopefully,
yes.
when it's done right.
Yes.
Exactly. It's not like we have all this knowledge and we're giving that to the patient, but we are gaining in that relationship ourselves and learning about our spiritualities.
Absolutely.
What do you think the biggest challenges are, though, for someone in that role in terms of helping people, let's say if someone's terminally ill or profoundly ill, what are the biggest challenges for you as a spiritual care volunteer?
I find that the challenges, and this would just be me, but I find the challenges to tame the other things in your life, to devote as much energy as this job, this practice requires. And once you realize how much it does, you respect that. You feel you prepare when you come. You know, you really put aside the proper amount of time. You make it your business to read and think and pray to get prepared. Sometimes that's hard because life gets in the way. You get a flat tire, or you know, the refrigerator goes bluey or something, and that can be a difficult part of it. But it isn't something that most of us, I would say, from what I've heard from the volunteers, almost every one of them puts a great deal of energy into this and gets a great deal out of it.
So there's a lot of devotion to
it. Oh, yes.
Terry, what do you think, though, is, you know, in terms of a challenge, what do all of these people may have in common in terms of their ability to face that kind of challenge? Because it seems to me that is a major core issue when you're facing people in great pain or suffering or perhaps facing death.
That's exactly right. And you use the word helping. There's a wonderful quote by Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen, but she says, you know, helping and fixing are two tendencies that actually kind of put people in a one-down position. We're about serving. And in serving, we utilize our own suffering. We don't disclose it. Like if I was to tell you, oh, I've been in the hospital, I know what it's like to be a patient, but we remember what it's like and use what we've gone through in our lives to have a bigger heart, an open heart. And the title of the book actually is Open the Eyes of My Heart, which comes from the book of Ephesians, which has to do with really looking inside, but making space for all and also utilizing everything we've gone through, and that it's not without purpose.
You know, it's interesting. Do you think that there is more need for this kind of spirituality these days in a somewhat highly secularized world? I mean, what's your sense? Has the program changed?
It has. Actually, one of the most fascinating studies is done by the Pew Forum, and it's showing that American spirituality is very high. 95% have a belief in God or higher power, but the practice has changed. It's more eclectic. It's more combined. It's more integrative. There's mixed marriages. A third of the country has a mixed marriage, for example, in different traditions. So absolutely need, especially in times of crisis.
Yes, there's a need. And also, as you see, there's a renewed interest in spiritual, all kinds of spiritual topics. And you see that in movies and books these days, going back to biblical themes.
Absolutely.
So in a little bit of time we have left, Walt, what do you hope will happen as a result of this book?
Well, I hope that the book will find its way, and we'll try to ensure that it finds its way somehow, into the hands of people who are asking themselves, how can I be a better caregiver, not just in the hospital setting, but maybe in their lives? How can I make my heart bigger, as Terry said? And that these stories will give them support, will give them some ideas, will start a process that opens the eyes of their hearts. Mm. And that's what we're hoping for.
Well, I think it's an incredible undertaking and a wonderful one. And I applaud you for doing what you're doing in both the volunteer work and in writing this book. How does somebody get involved, Reverend Culbertson, if they wanted to, in this program?
I would recommend check our website out from the Upstate website, search for spiritual care, or call us directly at 315-464-4687.
Wonderful. We'll have a link to that on our website as well as a way to find out more about the book. So I want to say that my guests have been Reverend Terry Culbertson. She is the manager of the Department of Spiritual Care at Upstate Medical University, and Walt Wasilewski. He's a lay volunteer with that same center. Thanks again for sharing all this with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next up, what does it take to be a level 1 trauma center? This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. Well, accidents can happen anytime, anywhere. But when they happen, it's essential to get help in a setting that's geared to provide the best care in the gravest of situations. Upstate University Hospital and Upstate Golisano Children's Hospital have that ability and have recently been verified as a Level 1 Pediatric and Adult Trauma Center. Here with more on this is Dr. Tamer Ahmed. He is the medical director of the Pediatric Trauma Program at Upstate Medical University, and Steve Atkinson, Pediatric Trauma Program Manager. Welcome. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
So Upstate University Hospital and Upstate Golisano Children's Hospital, it sounds to me, I just read that they're the first in the state to receive this national verification as a Level 1 trauma center. You have to tell us about that. What does it mean, Steve?
Well, it's a monumental thing for the community at large to have this service available, this level of care for pediatric patients and adult patients as well. We're dual verified as both adult and pediatric Level 1 trauma center, which is the highest level of designation issued by the American College of Surgeons. We're unique in that we're one of only 13 centers in the country that are dual verified. We are the only Level 1 pediatric trauma center in the state of New York. So Syracuse provides the penultimate, the highest level of trauma care available for pediatric patients in the state.
What does it actually mean, though, when we say a Level 1 trauma center? I mean, what is that?
I think that's why it's important to for the community to recognize is that we can say that we take great care of patients and we're very focused on our children that come in from our community. But to have a national organization come in, evaluate us very rigorously and say, yes, you meet the highest criteria that we can set, the highest standard available for the nation, and we are ecstatic and happy to give you this designation. It speaks a lot about what resources we have.
But I always thought, it was my maybe misunderstanding, that Upstate was always considered a Level 1 trauma center. But before we go on, can you define Level 1 trauma center? Just what does that really mean?
Level 1 is the highest. There's four levels of designation, through the American College of Surgeons, 1 through 4. And a lower number doesn't mean necessarily lower care. It's just a lower availability of resources available.
It's the expertise. It's a subspecialist available to care for these patients as far as pediatric neurosurgeons, pediatric orthopedists, pediatric emergency department. But particularly in the case of pediatric trauma, subspecialists that are focused on taking care of very different types of patients than these children. So that's the designation, and that's the difference between the levels is the availability of resources and subspecialists.
So this has changed. I'm sorry. So this has changed from when at one point it was considered a level or designated as a Level 1 trauma center. Perhaps the Department of Health did this, or how did that happen? But now there's this verification, so-called, is coming from a different organization. Please
Correct.
Explain that.
It's coming from the American College of Surgeons, which is actually an international organization. Initially started in the United States over 100 years ago now. And over the past several decades, they've worked on developing a trauma system in the United States, whereas patients that need expert-level care, that need intensive care, can get to the resources necessary. Part of that program, part of that process that they developed is this trauma system that they designate hospitals as either Level 1, Level 2, or Level 3 based on the resources. So it's a very wide-ranging evaluation process to designate these hospitals. Now, where that goes from here is a lot of our focusing our resources on what we have and making those resources available and having the American College of Surgeons come in and evaluate our program compared to other programs around the country and actually around the world.
But it's really important to have a Level 1, a verified Level 1 trauma center. Why? Is it so important?
I think it's critical because part of the Level 1 trauma designation is, like we keep touching on this use of resources, but if we look down into it, to have a pediatric neurosurgeon, Dr. Tovar Spinoza, or a pediatric orthopedist, or a pediatric emergency room in a hospital such as Upstate or Golisano Children's Hospital is very unique. These are resources that are in high demand, low availability nationwide. So to have all these resources under one roof is a very unique opportunity for us. And that's why we wanted to make sure that our opportunities, the experience that we have here, the subspecialists that we have here, the opportunities that we have for patients to get wonderful, wonderful world-class care is known and recognized.
Tell us a little bit more about this organization, the ACS. It's American College of Surgeons. You said it was 100 years old. And who do they represent, and how do they, you know, where does their imprimatur come from? Where does their, you know, ability to evaluate and designate?
So this is the trauma system that the American College of Surgeons, Let me step back. The American College of Surgeons is the largest group of surgeons, or is the largest surgeon organization.
I read somewhere 72,000 members.
Exactly. It's an overreaching organization. There are multiple different subspecialists ranging from pediatric surgeons to general surgeons. So it represents a wide swath of types of surgeons. And part of the American College of Surgeons is this trauma center designation. They've brought it amongst themselves to develop a trauma system throughout the nation, and they've been doing this now for 40 years, almost 40 years now, more than 40 years actually, and to develop the infrastructure required to have patients cared for in an expeditious and appropriate manner.
The college really recognized early on that trauma is a public health crisis. Trauma results in more deaths in the first 40 years of your life than any other cause. With pediatrics, trauma accounts for more deaths than all the other pediatric diseases combined. So when you look at it, Everett Koop said, you know, trauma was the unrecognized or unsung public health crisis that we deal with. So the college recognized this large number of patients, and there was no consistent model for treating them. So the college came up with a standardized approach, standards of care, standards of research and practice to provide the what's called the optimal treatment of the injured patient.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with surgeon Dr. Tamer Ahmed and Steve Atkinson, and we are talking about the importance of a Level 1 trauma center, which clearly we have here in Syracuse. Tell us how this was done. How were you verified? How did you get dual certification, and how was this accomplished?
Well, it's a very vigorous process. The college sends in 3 to 4 content experts in the form of very experienced trauma surgeons who are also program managers, come into your organization, and they evaluate how you care for the trauma patient, not just while they're in the hospital, but how you care for them before they even get to the hospital. Every aspect of your program is looked at rigorously. You're expected to participate significantly in research, in outreach, in public education, in what's called our quality improvement process. We have probably the most robust quality improvement process in the hospital because we vigorously look at our patients from multiple angles, always looking for a way to improve. And really, that and the way we collect data, those are just some of the aspects that the college look at, but it's a highly granular, very detailed look at your entire program, and especially at your process.
So they come by and they're on site for several days, and they evaluate all aspects, look at all your data, all your
correct.
Numbers.
Correct. They've actually pulled patients' charts and reviewed patients' charts and evaluated the care that we've provided meets or exceeds the standards that they've set. They've, as Steve mentioned, looked at what our involvement is in the community, making sure that we're doing appropriate measures as far as injury prevention, education. Because part of the trauma process isn't just taking care of the patient the child after they've been injured. It's trying to prevent that injury as much as possible. After the injuries happen, how do we support these patients, these children, and their families after they go home? So it's an overarching process, not just what happens inside our building, but how we can help this community around us.
So you must both feel very proud.
Well, very proud.
Well, we're happy for the community, to be honest with you. I think it's something that Syracuse and our entire region, actually, should be very proud of, to have this very unique resource available to us.
And it means a great deal for patients, as you said, especially if trauma is the leading cause or one of the leading causes.
Oh, it's, yeah, the yes. leading cause of death in children over the
and
age
disability.
Of 1.
And
that's another good point. And we always focus on the death rate in children, but it's also the devastating disability. This is something that doesn't just affect the child, but affects the entire family at this point. And it's an injury that children often have to live the rest of their lives with, so it has the overreaching consequences.
So let's get to specifics of what the injuries are that you generally see. In the pediatric world, I read somewhere that there were 11,000 visits to the mm-hmm. pediatric emergency room last year alone, and 2,200 of those were designated as trauma cases. What do they look like? What happens?
These are things that are very common. The families will immediately recognize anywhere ranging from a bone fracture, from a sports injury, to concussions, falls, motor vehicle accidents, for example, are the number one killer of teens from 15 to 20. So these are very common types of injuries that everybody recognizes, but the severity can sometimes be very surprising, whether it's the child playing in the street and struck by a car, or it's a nice summer day, so parents decide to open the window and the child, a little curious 2-year-old, falls out of the window. These are very, very common type of injuries that we see quite often.
Obviously very traumatic to everyone.
It can be
not
traumatic.
Only the child, but to everyone involved. On the adult side, I read somewhere that there were almost 67,000 visits to the emergency department last year. And a lot of those were also considered, almost 18,000 were classified as traumas. So it's obviously happening on both sides, children and adults.
Absolutely, no question. And I think that in part of the recognition of the community of the resources we have is seen in our visits to our emergency department, both on the pediatric and the ED side, and the amazing job that the emergency department physicians do in caring for these patients, both children and adults.
How large an area are you serving?
Our catchment area includes 14 counties. If you move north, we go as far as the St. Lawrence River, basically, and south to Pennsylvania. Heading west, we go as far as Auburn and beyond, and heading east beyond Herkimer. So we cover the second largest geographic area in the state, and we have the busiest trauma center in the state of New York. With that, we have 28 hospitals that transfer patients to us because, as Tamara brought out, we're the pinnacle of trauma care. So the service we provide is the outside hospitals that get a severely injured patient, don't have the resources to care for that patient, they get transferred to us.
The other very high-profile thing that you're often seeing on the news is that you have all these helicopter rescues or transports from other places, and I saw a number of something like 400 a year?
Yeah. Helicopters play an important role in the system, and long and short of it is they cut transport time and provide a higher level of care in the air, so they can get patients to us quicker, and if the medicine, time is everything.
So basically it saves lives. And we have a heliport?
We have a heliport on the 13th floor, the top of the 12th floor here in the hospital.
Amazing. So, Dr. Ahmed, what are the physicians, you've been alluding to the fact that one of the reasons for getting this kind of level one designation or verification is that we have this wealth of specialties. Give us a fuller range of the kinds of things that are here. Orthopedic surgeons, neurosurgeons, tell us a little bit more about that.
I think that's a good question, and it's important to recognize those individuals because this isn't an effort just by two people. This is the entire hospital banding together. It's from the moment a child is seen by the emergency medical services until they get to the emergency room, pediatric emergency room physicians, pediatric orthopedists, like we mentioned, pediatric surgeons, pediatric neurosurgeons. The real focus on physicians who take care of children, but it'd be wrong of me to just stop there. There are pediatric nursing, there's pediatric child life, there is social work, all on the pediatric, specific for children and their families, because I think we've recognized that the needs and the resources that we need in order to take care of children and their families are very unique. And it's really gone along building more than just the physicians, that's just part of it, but an entire system which cares for and focuses on children and their families. So physicians are a great part of it, they're very, very good, and we're very proud of them. But I think it's important also to recognize the pediatric nursing, the pediatric social workers, and the pediatric child life experts that really make sure that we take care of the entire family, not just the disease.
It really is a systems approach. It goes from every personnel level in the hospital supports this effort some way.
Well, it sounds like we have a lot of support and something to be very proud of. I want to thank you both for coming in and sharing that with us.
Thanks for having us.
Great information. My guests have been Dr. Tamer Ahmed, the assistant professor of surgery and pediatrics at Upstate Medical University, and he's also the medical director of the pediatric trauma program at Upstate, and Steve Atkinson, pediatric trauma program manager. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. You gotta believe, or here's how to make ourselves believe. Well, folks, tons of research shows the single best predictor of successfully making a change in our lives is whether we believe we can do it. Let me say that again. The single best predictor of successful change is believing we can do it. Yes, indeedy, we gotta believe. Psychologists call this belief in our capacity to do a certain specific task self-efficacy. Well, Dr. Neckup, you might say, what about ambitious goals that we know we couldn't do, say, tomorrow or next week or next month? We may even have tried and tried and failed and are sure we can't succeed, but still want to. What then, Dr. Know-it-all research-quoting Smarty Pants? Well, Dr. Smarty Pants says, we gotta cheat. Redesign the goal so we can be sure of success. An example. For years, I've had the very ambitious goal of running a marathon in under 3 hours. Actually, I want to beat Lance Armstrong's sub-3 time when he ran the New York City Marathon. Do I believe I can? Short term? No way. No way. I could probably run a 3.5-hour marathon with a hefty dose of training and a heftier tailwind. But that goal still bumps around in my head. What to do? Well, designate sub-3 a long-term goal and set a bunch of short-term, day-to-day goals that I know I can reach. How? Measure where I am right now, my baseline. Make a plan, a reasonable day-to-day plan to get there from here with lots of daily success to build my self-efficacy and keep me motivated. So, for example, I follow a marathon training plan based on all the available research, and being a research guy, that helps me believe. And it has specific recommendations, i.e. goals for each day, and cumulative goals for every week, and so on. And looking at those daily to-dos, I believe I can do them for sure based on my recent history as a runner. Next week's checkup from the neck up, what if we get started, do the plan, and aren't getting where we want to go? Hint, I was sure I could get this far in this checkup from the neck up, started writing it, and still found I had more to say. So tune in again next week. I'm Dr. Rich, one step at a time runner O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Next, what health screenings must women have throughout their lives to maintain good health? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for May 26th. Studies show that a relaxing dinner is always beneficial when you're eating with company or alone. This week, try to create a positive atmosphere by dining at a table with place settings and turning all devices off. Your mother would be so proud. Now sit up straight, have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen. And you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Women need to make healthy choices when it comes to diet, exercise, and overall lifestyle in order to maintain good health. But along with these efforts, there are specific health screenings that are recommended for women at certain ages. And here with more on this is Heather Shannon, certified nurse midwife and director of Upstate Midwifery and Gynecology. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you, Linda.
So women need to be proactive when it comes to their health. Diet, exercise, no smoking, maintain a healthy weight, limit alcohol consumption, all the things you and I have talked about. But now I want to get to health screenings. There are different recommendations at different ages. And I thought we could go through, for the good of our listeners, the ones that are recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. So let's begin with blood pressure testing. When should you start that, and how often, you know, to do it at different ages?
Well, it's a good question, Linda. You know, when we were born, that's our first blood pressure check. So pretty much every time we go to the doctors, whether it's every 6 months, whether it's every year, every 2 years, we do have our blood pressure taken. However, for recommendations for a young person between the ages of 18 and 39, we should at least get it tested every 2 years. And that does also go for ages 40 to 49 and even through age 65, so at least every 2 years. However, if we do have high blood pressure or a higher blood pressure of 120 over 80 or greater, then we definitely need to be evaluated at least every year. If we are diagnosed with hypertension, and then we have to follow the recommendations per our doctor or provider.
Okay, how about something like bone density testing? That's really come into popular understanding these days, understanding the importance of that. Tell us about that. How, at what ages should we start and how often?
So in terms of bone density testing, that is a screening test for osteoporosis. And that should be taking place when you are postmenopausal. So for most women at the age of 50 or around the age of 50, if you are a person who is on immunosuppressant therapy or long-term glucocorticoid steroid therapy, which is steroids, you should have your bone density exam done earlier. And it should be about every 2 years, assuming that your results are normal. If they're abnormal, then you and your doctor or provider will come up with a plan to have more frequent bone density screenings. But typically, it's when you're postmenopausal, which is right around the age of 50.
And some people do have a higher risk due to family history and what have you. So those people also probably would have to look at it in terms of the frequency. Might be a little more frequent.
Correct. One other thing with young girls who are taking Depo-Provera, that does decrease the bone mineralization, and it is recommended that they do have a bone density about every 3 to 5 years while on Depo-Provera.
What is the Depo-Provera for?
Depo-Provera is an injection for birth control.
Oh, right. Okay, that's a long-acting birth control. Yeah. How about breast cancer screening? Now, that we know is mammography, and that has come up with, there's been a lot of controversy around the recommended ages and frequency. Tell us about that.
Well, the newest recommendations are stating that at the age of 50, we should begin our screenings and then have it performed every 2 years. And now this is to assume that this is a patient or a woman who does not have any risk factors for breast cancer. Now, depending on your family history as well as your own personal history, you and your provider will make a decision as to when screening should occur. So it's not unusual to have a baseline mammogram at the age of 35 with a strong family history of breast cancer in your first degree relative, so a mother or a sister, as well as possibly a genetic link. So if you have the positive BRCA1 or BRCA2, then yes, 35, and then you and your provider will come up with standard recommendations or standard testing, which is mammography and possible ultrasound or MRI for breast cancer screening. But 50 is now the newest recommendations. Is it wrong to start it at 40? I guess that's the conversation you need to have with your provider to determine what's best for you.
There have been so much controversy around it. And I said on a very large scale, when you're talking about public health, they say that the numbers don't support starting that young. But if you're an individual and you are concerned, as you said, you really need to discuss this with your own doctor, and it should be on a case-by-case basis.
Exactly.
How effective do you think that breast exams are these days? I know there was a time when they felt that breast exams were not really going to pick up breast cancer sufficiently. I mean, at first it was very popular, then they said it's really not as effective, then they said, so you have to do mammography. And of late, I think this pendulum has swung a little bit the other way. What's your experience in terms of breast exams?
So it's very important for each and every one of us to understand our breast tissue, our own breast tissue. So yes, we need to make sure we are doing a breast exam monthly, if not every other month. We are the only ones that know our bodies. In terms of teaching breast exams and encouraging women to do that as a first line, I totally support that because, again, we are familiar with our breasts and we know when there's something abnormal. And we've got to not be afraid. We've got to be proactive to take that step to do an annual breast exam on a monthly basis, not annual, but monthly. Mm-hmm. And it's very simple. Step out of the shower, you're toweling off, look in the mirror. Do you see anything unusual? And your provider should be able to explain to you what you are looking for. Even when you are showering and you are washing with your washcloth or soap, you can do a quick breast exam in the shower so it's not so intrusive or invasive or embarrassing or uncomfortable.
Very good advice. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen. I'm here with certified nurse midwife Heather Shannon. We're talking about the very important health screenings that women should have at the various different ages. Let's get on to cervical cancer screening. That's Pap testing, and I guess also looking for something like HPV. tell us about when that should take place.
Correct. So let me explain a little bit about HPV. It is a human papillomavirus, and it is known to cause 99.7% of cervical cancer. So the medical field has really gotten smart on figuring out what can cause or is the major cause of cervical cancer. So over the years of the studies and the meta-analysis where they look at all the studies across the world, they have come up, this organization called the American Society of Colposcopy and Cervical Pathology came up with some recommendations with other national organizations and worldwide organizations to determine what is best for women in terms of cervical cancer screening. We understand HPV is a slow-growing cancer. So you could be exposed 10 years ago and not have any results until
today.
That
are positive.
Correct. Okay. So the current recommendations are a pap smear. Your first pap smear should be at the age of 21 and not any younger, even if you are sexually active. And if your pap smear is normal, every 3 years. And this is a huge change for us. We're used to going to our doctor's office and having a pap smear every year. This is a new recommendation within the last 3 to 4 years, and even 5 years now, but we're really starting to really enforce this or act upon this, that age 21 is your first pap smear every 3 years thereafter if it's normal. And if you are 30 or over, you can have your pap smear and an HPV digene screen to determine whether you have been exposed to HPV ever in your lifetime. And that can be performed every 5 years after the age of 30.
Is the rationale for the spacing between the fact that the HPV virus is so slow growing? Is that your point here?
It is. The HPV virus can hibernate. It can hide. So you can have your initial insult or infection, and then it hides, and your body doesn't recognize it until it starts to change the cells. And at that point, you have an abnormal pap smear.
But you have enough time at that point, if you're waiting 3 years in between pap smears, to take effective action is the point.
Correct. Very correct. Yes.
Okay. Very quickly, what's chlamydia testing? Why do you have it and when should we have it?
So chlamydia is a sexually transmitted disease, and it's very important to have that performed on a yearly basis right up through the age of 24, because typically we're younger and we have more sexual partners. And a lot of times we don't have protected sex with a condom. So you are at a higher risk of developing this chlamydia infection, which is a sexually transmitted disease. So after the age of 25, you still should consider having it done yearly until the age of 35. However, it's an option.
It's more optional?
It's more optional. However, in my practice, I encourage patients to have a chlamydia test right up through the age of 35, as CDC recommends.
How about something very general that we already know is very important, cholesterol testing? Let's just very quickly review. Why do we test it? At what ages should you start testing it? And, you know, what are we looking for?
So, very good question. Cholesterol, we know, is a culprit, or high cholesterol is a risk for heart disease. So we should have our screening at the age of 20. And every few years thereafter, when you have risk factors, and obesity and smoking, as well as a strong family history, are these risk factors that you would want to be proactive in your health and have your cholesterol screening
Every couple of years or every year?
If you have high cholesterol, it does have to be done on a yearly basis. If you have a normal cholesterol, then you can space out those screenings.
And you're looking really more for the LDL, the bad cholesterol.
The bad cholesterol
that
as well.
Causes plaque development and clogging of your arteries.
Correct.
And that kind of thing.
Correct.
Okay, what about, this is a big one, and obviously we talk about this for men and women, but the whole notion of colorectal cancer screening. And there are several ways they do this, either through a fecal blood test, sigmoidoscopy, which is not the entire colon, and then the big colonoscopy. When should you start that kind of testing, and how often?
So the recommendations currently is to start at the age of 50. And you should have a colorectal screening between every 5 to 10 years, depending on your results. If you should have a family history of colon cancer, especially within your first degree relatives, your mom, your dad, brothers or sisters, then you may need to have your screening earlier than the age of 50. If you are having any symptoms, rectal bleeding, a lot of diarrhea, a lot of abdominal pain, you need to see your gastroenterologist or your primary care doctor so you can be further evaluated.
So that's crucial, because it's one of the things that truly can, if you have that colonoscopy, if you have that screening, you can prevent death, whereas colon cancer alone is a very big killer.
Correct.
So it's silent, and you really need to make sure on a regular basis that you are not, you're not developing a polyp that will become cancerous.
Correct.
What about diabetes screening?
Diabetes screening. So we are a larger society now, and so we have a lot of comorbidities associated with that, such as high blood pressure and diabetes. So if you have high blood pressure, then I think you really need to be evaluated for diabetes. Otherwise, you can have that performed at your annual visits, whether it's every 2 to 3 years for a well woman exam when you get your pap smear, or every year or more frequently per your doctor's recommendations. But anytime you have symptoms or you have comorbidities like high blood pressure or obesity.
Well, we see more and more people and children with diabetes.
Correct.
So obviously this should be a regular thing. I don't want to run out of time. How about things like gonorrhea, HIV, and syphilis? Obviously that isn't going to be necessary annually. So very briefly.
For best practices, it's very important to ask every time a patient comes in whether they would like to be screened for HIV. You do not have to have high-risk behaviors to be exposed to HIV, which is sex or IV. However, it's important to be offered at every visit on an annual basis. Gonorrhea and syphilis, these are common. However, gonorrhea should be done with a chlamydia test because they're usually done together. And then syphilis, it's a very rare condition. However, you should be offered to be screened whenever you think you've been exposed to any kind of sexually transmitted disease.
Well, I want to thank you, Heather. This is such important information. Appreciate your coming in. My guest has been Heather Shannon, certified nurse midwife and director of Upstate Midwifery and Gynecology. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. We write for many reasons, sometimes to affirm our existence, to insist upon our meaning, sometimes to memorialize those who have passed on before us. Claudia M. Redder teaches at California State University, the Channel Islands. In this poem, she memorializes a sculptor whose work has kept her company since childhood and finds in his work a thread that extends to her own and to all who do the hard work of creation. Here is Redder's poem for DR Sculptor. 1. Girl on a fence, 8 inches tall, cast in bronze, sits on a sill so that we look out the same window. She straddles the present, my past, and the marvel of daydream. When I look at her, I am 10. I am the girl on the fence, wrapped up in books. I read Chekhov's biography, then Catullus. Not understanding what I read, the words glide by on their own slopes. After school, I hike down the hill to the Carnegie Library, whose halls echo like a grand ballroom under my loafers. I nod to Egyptian gods, Mesopotamian pillars, and 2 marble lions before climbing the wide staircase to the adult reading room where I reach for the novel hidden behind the shelves. 2. Girl holding an owl, chiseled from a single block of wood, always stands near my front door. After my parents' divorce, this 3-foot-high guardian became my dream image, an owl with eyes like searchlights, whose wingspan fends off nightmares from the woodpecker tapping each dawn at my bedroom's rotting wooden window frame to the drawing of a house my grandmother asked me to make for her every so often. 3. When muscular dystrophy made it impossible for you to carve wood or cast bronze, you sculpted with wax. I have learned that paper is my sky, words are my dreaming. This poem is to reaffirm that whatever we are dealt, we will create, transform, and offer to the world our delicate, vulnerable shapes.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we learn how close we are to a cure for HIV/AIDS, plus what Upstate's new cord blood center will mean for Central New York, and the latest news about improvements in complications from diabetes. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.